This week on The Score, the 31st Annual Virginia Film Festival approaches. Canada joins Mexico and the United States in a trade deal. Fifth District Congressional candidates debate. All this and more on The Score. Don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. We've got quite a variety this week. Autumn brings falling leaves, candidate debates, and, in Charlottesville, the Virginia Film Festival. Election Day is less than a month away, but the film festival is even closer. This week I spoke with the director of the Virginia Film Festival, Jody Kilbasa, who is also Vice Provost for the Arts at the University of Virginia, and Wesley Harris, the film festival's chief programmer. They gave us a preview of the 31st Annual Virginia Film Festival, which will take place at multiple venues in Charlottesville on the weekend of November 1st, through the fourth. First question I want to ask is, the Virginia Film Festival has shown a lot of Oscar winners in the past. The Artist, Slumdog Millionaire, West Bank Story. What films do you have this year that have a lot of Oscar buzz?
Oh my goodness, well I think we have a number of those films. Certainly the centerpiece film Roma by Alfonso Cuarón has been leading the pack with discussion about, you know, being an Oscar hopeful. But certainly Yorgos Lanthimos' film The Favorite, which stars Emma Stone and Olivia Colman and Rachel Weisz, also has gotten a lot of Oscar buzz. I've heard some mention about The Front Runner, which is our closing night film, and Widows has gotten some talk of that as well. So, and Green Book, which won the audience favorite award at Toronto Film Festival. So we have a number of films that I think that have positioned themselves really, really well for that.
And on top of that, all of those the respective countries' entries into the best foreign language category, those dozens, really, which are kind of floating around, get winnowed down to that final five or ten, however many they settle on. So with 15 this year, and some of them especially buzzworthy, I expect some of those will end up there as well.
And who are some of the guest speakers that you're going to have at the film festival this year, presenting their films or talking on panels?
Well, I think we mentioned earlier that we have Martin Luther King III, who's going to come in as a guest speaker, and he'll give a community address and also be in a moderated discussion with Professor Larry Sabato after the screening of the new documentary Charlottesville. So he'll be weighing in on that as well. We have Peter Bogdanovich in, and Wesley, you might want to talk a little bit more about the tribute to Orson Welles that Peter will weigh in, and of course he's also in with the new film, The Other Side of the Wind. I shouldn't say new film, it's an old film, but new,
because
it
had a
new release.
Yes. It's like a 45-year-old film that's just being
released. Well, it's really just come to, it really took those 40 years to actually take shape, so it's not like it's just been sitting on a shelf. It was entangled in a lot of legal and rights issues for decades, even when Welles was alive. So it wasn't simply uncompleted because of his death. It was already an issue for him even then.
Right.
So Bogdanovich and others have really, honestly, been working 40 years straight on this movie.
And Peter Bogdanovich has been at the film festival before, right?
He was here close to 10 years ago. And
what's cool this year, too, with Bogdanovich is that it's almost like he's walking arm in arm with Welles this year. At least that was very much the feeling at Telluride.
Well, he's been walking arm in arm with Welles for 20, 30 years.
Right.
But it's also very current with a brand new documentary out, The Great Buster, about silent film legend and star Buster Keaton.
Through a very modern lens, a lot of those the talking heads, like, well, both the old guard, like Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner and Herzog, but also Like I said, Bill Hader and Nick Kroll and Tarantino. It's a really interesting and sort of youthful and vibrant lens through which people may be able to discover Keaton.
Speaking of documentaries, what other types of documentaries do you have coming to the film festival this year?
Well, we talked about the National Geographic films. Free Solo, I would be surprised if ultimately that is not one of the documentaries that is considered for an Academy Award. Into the Okavango, which is a stunning look at the Okavango River. Science Fair is another one of those films. Biggest Little Farm, I think I mentioned, is just a favorite of mine that takes a look at this young couple that decide they're going to become farmers, but they're going to do it right. It's going to be sustainable, no pesticides. They're going to do it the old way, and they find out suddenly that it takes care of itself. It's amazing. They don't shoot predators, but they find out the predators start, you know, killing the hedgehogs and the moles and everything that you would normally think would trash the farm and make it impossible for them to do the crops. They suddenly start finding that you know, aphids are eating the ladybugs that are destroying the peaches. I mean, all these different things that take care of itself without using pesticide. It's a beautifully filmed movie, and you just end up feeling great about it and wondering, why can't we do it this way all the time?
Interesting. This is going to be sort of a curveball question, but you've probably heard it before. What is the mission of the Virginia Film Festival?
Well, I would say from my perspective, the mission really is to, really at the core, we're presenting the very best films in a given year in cinema, but it's engaging our community in a dialogue. With over 150 films, Rick, that we screen, just think of the broad canvas that we can paint on with the topics and the subject matters. Wesley mentioned 15 films that are likely to represent their country as their Academy Award entry. Well, think of the cultures that are explored that way, the various subject matters, the windows that you open up on other worlds, and we're able to bring that to Charlottesville and engage people in the discussion of similarities and differences, films about religion and politics and history, sexuality, so many different topics that you can explore. And, you know, I find it amazing. People may not want to go to a lecture about a very difficult subject, but they'll see that film, and then they'll stay and they'll want to talk about it because they're moved to open up to discuss the topic of that film. And I think that's a very important thing. That's what the movies do, is they bring people together for a shared experience.
And on top of that, we're able to do... able to operate within several different modes of what many other festivals attempt or silo themselves within. We can accomplish those all at once, by which I mean championing the work of new and emerging filmmakers, names that you would not know at this moment but might be very familiar with 5 or 10 years from now, alongside icons of cinema like we've talked about, where alongside films that are submitted blind to us, to things that Jody and I go out and scout from the festival circuit, to the award season contenders. We're able to put the intellect of our local audience to work in that way, which is a real treasure for me to be able to curate for. I think we've got one of the best audiences in the world, and I love programming for them.
Well, I certainly enjoy the panel discussions that come after many of the films. It's really something special about the Virginia Film Festival that I really appreciate. But Jody Cabasso, Wes Harris, thank you for presenting this today, and I look forward to the film festival in about a month.
Thank you, Rick.
Likewise.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Over the next few weeks, we will have more interviews with filmmakers and scholars about the movies at the Virginia Film Festival. Go to BearingDrift.com for more information.
Did you miss a previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at BearingDrift.com.
Earlier this week, Canada joined the United States and Mexico in a successor to the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. The new trade deal will be called the USMCA, according to President Trump. Over the telephone, I asked trade policy specialist Daniel Griswold at the Mercatus Center about the new agreement.
When we last spoke a few weeks ago, there was some uncertainty about whether there would be a negotiated agreement to replace the North American Free Trade Agreement. And Monday, there was an announcement that Canada had come on board. How does this new U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement differ from NAFTA, and is it better or worse?
It differs in a number of respects. It's largely similar, and that's the good news. NAFTA survives, even if you change the name, it's mostly intact. The biggest differences, the biggest negative difference is in automobiles, how it treats automobiles, and this is one of the most important industries affected by NAFTA. We have a integrated, globally competitive North American auto industry that's done very well under NAFTA. This changes the rules of origin, which determine how much North American content has to be in a car for it to qualify for duty-free access. It used to be 62%. Now it's 75%, and 40% of that content has to be made by labor earning more than $16 an hour, which means U.S. or Canadian, but not Mexican. This is supposed to help the domestic U.S. auto industry. I'm skeptical that it will. It will make their operations less efficient. Some of that production may go to third countries rather than stay in North America. Prices may go up for Americans who buy automobiles. So that's a net negative. There's a few other things. On the positive side, give the president his due. We did get Canadian dairy duties down. I think that was an exaggerated issue, but they've eliminated or reduced some of the dairy tariffs. We've raised the minimus, and that's the minimum level of packages that don't get charged with customs. And this is very important to small and medium-sized enterprises, shipping, digital trade is part of it. The settlement mechanism is largely intact. So there's some positives, some negatives. On the whole, it probably isn't quite as good as the original NAFTA. It's still largely intact, and the business community, American consumers can breathe a big sigh of relief that this successful agreement will continue.
We're talking with Daniel Griswold from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University about trade policy, and in particular about the successor to NAFTA. I read some news reports that indicated that it may be cheaper for Americans to buy imported cars with a full tariff than with the cars that will be produced under these new arrangements in the USMCA. Is that true?
I think that's quite possible. Yes. You know, they've layered on so many new requirements for cars to qualify for duty-free movement under NAFTA that it may just make more sense to either pay the 2.5% duty on vehicles made in Mexico coming into the United States, or maybe just shift some of that production to third countries and import them directly into the United States. And I have no problem with imports. I think Americans should be free to buy imported clothing, furniture, cars, whatever they're interested in. But if you're trying to promote domestic production, this could be counterproductive, you know. Even if a car is assembled, a truck is assembled in Mexico, it has a high degree of U.S. components. Maybe 40% of those components made in the U.S. If we somehow encourage that production to go to third countries, I think that share of U.S. Imports in the final product will be significantly less. So I think the administration scored something of a political victory. The president can say, rightfully, I renegotiated NAFTA, I put my stamp on it, but I think economically Americans are not going to be better off because of the changes that the president insisted upon.
What are the incentives for automobile manufacturers to pay $15 or $16 an hour to Mexican workers who would normally work for like a third of that? This going to cause high levels of unemployment in Mexico and perhaps increase Mexican migration into the United States?
Well, let's take those one at a time. I think the main effect will not be so much to raise wages in Mexico. As you say, their wages are pretty significant, below $16 an hour. I think the effect will be to shipped some production either to the U.S. or overseas. And that leads to your very good point that if we cause dislocation and unemployment in Mexico, that could lead to more migration to the United States. You know, looking at it more positively, one reason why Mexican migration to the United States has fallen in recent years, one, we've had our own economic issues here, but it's been increased opportunities in Mexico. And this was one of the longer-term promises of NAFTA, right? If we integrated Mexico into the North American economy, encouraged their government to move to a more market-based economy, a more open economy, to create middle-class opportunities and keep more younger Mexicans at home. And that has ultimately worked. Mexico is a successful, pluralistic, democratic society today, and NAFTA has played a part in that. And this, it's not going to be a disaster, but this turns that back a little bit, and we're going to create more distance between us and Mexico rather than more closeness and integration.
Are there any other changes in labor regulations in other industries? I know that the automotive industry has been getting the most attention, but are there other industries that we should be looking out for?
That's a good question. I think the only other industry that was targeted for major changes is the textile and apparel industry. And they're often talked together, but they're two quite different industries. Apparel, of course, is the final clothing product, and most of those jobs left the United States decades ago, not so much to Mexico, but to China and Vietnam, and those jobs aren't coming back. And we wouldn't want them back. They're not very good manufacturing jobs. Textile, that produces the cloth, right? The kind of wholesale cloth that goes into final products. Some of that production has remained in the United States. That's very capital intensive. You need these sophisticated mechanical looms and all that. And they've tweaked NAFTA to try to make any apparel production in Mexico use more American cloth, more American textiles. I don't know if that'll work. Again, it may just make more sense to pay the duties or take it offshore. But again, it's protectionism, isn't it? The textile industry has gotten protection over decades. This was their way of getting a little bit more, and unfortunately they have a sympathetic administration.
Now, we're moving from discussions among executive leaders, the President of the United States, President of Mexico, Prime Minister of Canada, and now it goes to the various countries' legislatures. Do you
Yes.
think there are any bumps in the road in terms of ratification of this agreement in any of those legislative bodies?
I think Mexico isn't going to be very controversial. They signed off on that. Canada, maybe a little more so. There's some pushback against Prime Minister Trudeau that maybe he gave up too much, but I think that'll ultimately pass there. Probably the biggest question mark is the United States. I think USTR Bob Lighthizer is exaggerating the support that this is going to gain from Democrats and from left-of-center constituencies such as labor unions. You know, they've been calling for enforceable labor rights and things like that, but it never seems to be enough. So even the United Auto Workers Union is withholding judgment. At the end of the day, I don't think you'll see much more Democratic support than you've had for trade agreements in the past. If it's going to pass Congress, it's going to have to be with overwhelming Republican support. You know, I'm not a paid political handicapper. I think it's quite possible it will pass Congress. Congress has never actually voted down a trade agreement in the past, so it could be close, but I think it will follow the usual pattern. Some Democratic support, overwhelming Republican support with the support of the president to get it across the finish line.
And assuming it does cross that finish line, what's the next step for trade policy? Who are our next trade partners that need to be renegotiated, or perhaps some new arrangements with countries that we don't currently have trade agreements with?
Yeah, I think the next big three trade controversies, and one's already in full throttle, and that's with China. And I wish I could be more hopeful about that, but we may be in for a medium to long-term struggle with China, and there are going to be no winners from that. The tariffs that the president is imposing and headed up to tariffs on maybe $500 billion worth of Chinese imports are hurting China, but they're hurting Americans too. American consumers and families that buy these products, including what families hope to put under their Christmas tree, are facing significant tariffs. That's hurting American producers, right? They're using components and other things imported from China as part of their business model. And then we're suffering retaliation. Talk to soybean farmers in the Midwest. China's, at least up until recently, was a major market there. So that's an ongoing issue. I think also with the European Union and Japan. And there the president is brandishing the threat of 20% to 25% duties on imported automobiles, which again would hurt producers in the European Union and Japan, but it would hurt millions of American families too with higher automobile prices and would invite retaliation. So, you know, we could have had a free trade agreement with Japan. It was called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It virtually opened up the Japanese market to U.S. agricultural exports and manufactured trade. The president withdrew us from that very early on in his tenure. Seems like we're going back and trying to reinvent the wheel and probably get a less good deal than we would have gotten by just staying in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We also had ongoing negotiations with the European Union, which we were drawn from. So, again, I think there's going to be a lot of threats. Perhaps tariffs, maybe with Japan, the European Union, and maybe China, there'll be some agreement at the end of the day that may or may not leave us better off than we are now. It just seems a lot of sound and fury and tariffs and real economic damage for very questionable results.
In terms of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, did that hold together without the United States, or is that being renegotiated by its other partners?
The other 11 countries went ahead and signed it without the United States. They got rid of about 20 provisions that the U.S. was very keen on, mostly having to do with intellectual property, and they went ahead and signed those agreements. So Australian beef ranchers have duty-free access to the Japanese market, whereas U.S. Ranchers still face 38% tariffs and a number of other examples like that. So we had a chance to be part of a huge integrated market with zero tariffs virtually all around, but we forfeited that opportunity. We could get back in. May not be quite as good a deal as it was before, but, you know, there's a theme here. We are losing out on opportunities. For example, Japan has gone ahead and signed a free trade agreement with the European Union. So Japanese auto producers have duty-free access to the European market without firing a shot in a trade war, whereas we're going to go through all this huffing and puffing and maybe some real damage to try to get better access to your European market. There's a better way to do these things than the president's confrontational brinksmanship approach.
But the brinksmanship approach makes for much better television, doesn't it?
Seem to be his style. I think he sees the world as a kind of confrontational, win-lose, zero-sum approach. He said tariffs are good, and so imposing them doesn't bother him one bit, even if it does create problems across heartland America. So, yes, and politically, I think part of his base wants confrontation. It's just that we're paying a real price, and there are better ways to achieve these things. If the president wants a world with lower or zero tariffs and zero subsidies, I'm with him. but this isn't the way to go about achieving that.
Well, we'll leave it with that thought. I appreciate your time today, Dan Griswold of the Mercatus Center. I'm glad you joined us again on The Score from Bering Drift, and I hope we have a chance to talk again soon, maybe with better prospects ahead.
Thank you, Rick.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
When The Score returns, we'll hear excerpts from a congressional candidates debate with Leslie Coburn and Denver Riggleman, who are competing for the vacant 5th District seat in Central Virginia. And pulled from the archives, Jonathan V. Last of the Weekly Standard will tell us about declining birth rates around the world and what that means for our future. We'll be right back.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com. You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
And we're back. You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift, and I'm your host, Rick Sincere. Just after the deadline for last week's episode of The Score, two candidates for Congress in Virginia's 5th District faced off in a cordially civil debate at the University of Virginia, hosted by the Frank Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy. In this excerpt from the end of the 90-minute debate, Democrat Leslie Coburn and Republican Denver Riggleman answer a question about questions and then make their closing statements.
My final question, as I've been to both of you, and invites a wholesome response, it's very nice. We appreciate your opportunity to ask you so many questions about public policy and leadership, but our time is necessarily short. What one additional question do you wish we had asked of you? And what one question do you wish me to ask of your opponent? We're going to give you a very generous 90 seconds each, and we're going to let you resolve it very quickly.
Can we pass?
No, sir. Starting with Ms. Coburn, what question do you wish we'd ask of you? And what one question do you wish we'd ask of your opponent?
That's a really hard question. That's a really hard question.
You've asked a lot of questions here.
I think there's a big question that we haven't, I brought it up for a moment, but we haven't really talked about it, which is climate change. I think there are a lot of people who are concerned in this room about climate change, as I am. I think we need to look very carefully at the fact that the United States is the only country now that is not signed on to the Paris Accord. And I am delighted that there are states and businesses in this country who have refused to go along with that and who have acted on their own. We have huge climate change issues in the Fifth. I mentioned the pipelines, I mentioned the methane. The Trump administration has just loosened restrictions on methane leakage. Methane is 25 times more powerful than CO2. These restrictions should not be loosened because we're all in serious danger because of that. I think that for me it's a top priority, and in terms of what I would want people to ask of my opponent,
thank you very much. Mr. Riggleman, you're recognized for 9 seconds.
So for me, I was surprised. I don't think we had a specific question about opioids tonight that I remember. And it was something that, based on just some of the studying that I've done, I thought that opioids might come up based on what we've seen in the 5th District. There's a few things that I have some stats that I want to go over that I think you guys might find pretty interesting. And boy, this was a tough one. Number one, if you look at, there's multiple border areas where we have opioids transshipments, but also China. And, you know, for me, when looking at counterintelligence and counterterrorism, I'm looking at, say, there's something called the JIATF South, which is a Joint Interagency Task Force. And what they found, I can't give you the exact numbers, is about 20 to 25% of drugs are interdicted. 20 or 25%, and they interdicted over 100 tons. So if you go down south of the opioids and synthetic opioids, you're getting across the border, right on the southern border, you're getting thousands of pounds and thousands of tons of drugs that are coming over. It's not just opioids, but also other stuff. But there's something else that's happening, it's China. I don't know if you guys know this with opioids, but China is actually mailing opioids using cryptocurrencies into the country. So when you start looking at all these things that are going on with rehabilitation and law enforcement and things of that nature, there's something else we have to look at, is how do we stop the flow of these drugs from all these cities that are coming into the country. So when we look at rehabilitation and things like that, I really thought somebody was going to ask me about marijuana as an exit drug. I really did. And the fact is, at this point, with the amount of addiction that we have, in some way, we have to look at marijuana as an exit drug for these opioid abusers.
We've come to that time in the program where we'll be looking for your closing statements. As
I had a question for Leslie.
You're trying to Ms. Cobra, you now recognize for your commitment to closing statements.
Thank you. I'm going to start my closing statement by just continuing on that thought about opioids and accountability and what can be done on Capitol Hill. For me, when I look at opioids, I look at the pharmaceutical companies who pushed opioids. There have been excellent investigations on this so far. We need to have those investigations on Capitol Hill. In the same way that the state of New York and Montana are bringing those investigations to court, let's bring that to Congress. Also, insurance companies who've made it much easier to get opioids than other drugs which are not so addictive. So we have problems right here at home. Accountability is a key thing for me. It's because of my background in journalism. Every story I ever did as a journalist had a piece in Washington, holding somebody's feet to the fire. Because when you do the kind of work I was doing, when you go into war zone after war zone after war zone, places where others do not want to go, to talk to people who don't have a voice, you realize that you need to speak truth to power no matter what the cost. It's what we call courage. Right now, we all need courage. It is a very tough business, politics. This right now, Charlottesville, this is the center of the universe. Things are happening here that I regard, having covered stories everywhere in the world. It's the most important thing going on in the world right now is right here. We are at the heart of the Trump wars. We are in a country that I believe is in danger of having our democracy slip away. I love history. I've studied many periods of American history. My family has been involved in important parts of American history, like World War I, where my grandfather earned his Silver Star by crossing the front line to clean out a machine gun nest in an extremely brave act. My father served in World War II. I think that we need service. We need to be involved and engaged, every single one of us, because for all of us, our grandchildren will ask, what were you doing in 2018? And I want to be one of the people who said, I stood up and I helped change the course of this country and bring our democracy back. Thank you very much.
Mr. Riggleman, you are now recognized for your closing statements. kids and for the generosity of our UK students, that there's a huge gap for them.
I saw that. I was really excited about that. Thank you. I know this comes off the website, fellow Wahoos, but it was something that I want to read before I start with this. Coming to the University of Virginia was a dream of mine, and there's a quote by Thomas Jefferson I want to read with this. Educate and inform the whole mass of people. They are the only sure reliance for the preservation of our liberty. The education that I got when we got back home, after 20 plus years on the road, whether military, supporting the National Security Agency, being overseas, doing counter-ID work, all the things that I had to do, was that when we came home and we built our distillery, we found out really quick, we got an education on how it really works. I despise politics. I hate it. I've been behind the door my whole life. I've been either fighting or I've been doing intelligence work. I've been with my daughters, my wife, for 11 years. They really didn't see me. And what you think when you come home, when you've served your country, that there's this free or there's this fair way of doing things. And when you walk into a state house or into a government house and you walk into an office of a delegate or you walk into the office of a senator or a representative, and we're looking at these individuals and you're like, these guys aren't listening to me because somebody owns them. And it happened to me for 4 years by myself. I didn't get involved in politics. I would go knock on the door and walk in and say, why are you doing this? Why are these tax laws ever, right? Why is your taxes 30 times more for this business than that business? And I kept getting the same thing. You have to play the game. You have to play the game. And I refused to. I kept thinking, and I honestly did, that if I used some kind of rationale towards this or some kind of good idea fairy, or that I could get somebody on my way of thinking based on how I could help the community, that if I did this and this and this, I could buy more from farmers and I could put more into the tax coffers. They didn't care because all they cared about is who was supporting them. All they cared about was getting reelected. They did not care. And finally, I had a lobbyist sit me down and he said this. He said, brother, you don't understand. If you're not at the dinner table, you're on the menu. When I look at everybody out here, there's something that just clicked to me that I have to fight. I will always err on the side of liberty. I can't help it. I don't believe the government can take care of all of our needs. I'm always going to be that way. What you'll get from me, though, is true. I'll be transparent. I know there's so many people who didn't agree with me today, but I'm just going to say yes or no, and this is how I feel. If you like it, great. That is how I'm going to be, and that's what I'm going to do. Vote for me. If you don't, don't. Because that's the great thing about living in this country. That's the great thing about living the American dream. That's the great thing about me serving my country, because all your ideas can be heard in this forum at the University of Virginia, that I never, a place I never thought I would get. So I thank you, and I thank the moderators and the students, and all my love for being a Wahoo, and thank you very much.
As a bonus for our podcast listeners, I had a chance to speak with Denver Riggleman after the debate. I asked him just two short questions about campaign contributors and congressional term limits. Your opponent obliquely attacked you for the source of your campaign donations. Do you take money from people because they want you to agree with them or because they agree with you?
Well, only if they agree with me. I've already refused PAC monies if they're looking at monopolization or if they try to pick winners or losers. For instance, some of the things she was saying is sort of disingenuous, but what it really comes down to is if people give me money, they have to agree with me because I'm pretty upfront, and people get to judge me on my integrity and what I do anyway. So,
and an attack on your campaign donors is an attack on your integrity.
It is, but you know, at this point in this game, I think she's a little bit behind, and I think she wants to make attacks like that. And what you do is you just sort of let her make those attacks, and people can make their own judgments.
I don't know why this question came up in my mind during the debate, but what do you think about addressing the dysfunctioning Congress through term limits?
I am a huge fan of term limits, even term limiting myself. So it's just the way that I'm wired. There's no way I'm going to do this as a career. I'm going to serve the best I can for a limited amount of time, then I'm going to move on.
Okay, thank you. That's all I need for today, but I appreciate your time.
Rick, as always, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Our From the Archives segment this week features a telephone interview from February 2013, 6 years ago, when I spoke to Jonathan V. Last of the Weekly Standard
about his then new book, What to Expect When No One's Expecting, America's Coming Demographic Disaster. Here's JVL.
I saw you on Red Eye the other night, and I was wondering what that experience was like for you. It was your first time on the show, as I understand it.
Yeah, that was my first time on Red Eye. That was almost the most fun I've ever had on television. It was really a good time. I used to go all the time. Dennis Miller, I don't know if you know him, he used to have a show on CNBC, and I used to go on that show once a month, and that show was the best, because he had like a monkey that ran around the studio while he was shooting the show, and like you could hang out with the chimp whose name was Mowgli, and he had like the greatest guests. I met Martin Landau in that. I met Stan Lee, a huge comic book nerd, and so like I got to hang out in the green room with Stan Lee for an hour. Anyway, so I would say Red Eye was right up there with the old Dennis Miller show.
Great, great. Yeah, I'm a night owl, so I watch Red Eye all the time, and it's a fun show. I think I learn more about public affairs there than I would by, say, watching John Stewart.
He has a real cult following, too, doesn't it? Like, it's really funny to sort of find the people who are Red Eye people.
Yeah, I can imagine it would. The second sort of softball question is, given the topic of your book, have you seen Mike Judge's film Idiocracy?
I have. I mentioned it briefly deep in the book, and yes, I've seen it, and it's funny. I think it's not nothing could ever be Office Space. Office Space is like, you know, one of the most perfect movies ever made. But Idiocracy is pretty funny too.
Do you think that movie makes a substantial point about where we're headed demographically?
No. What I say in the book is actually that, you know, so like there's this conservative misanthropic view, I think, of the world as idiocracy writ large, but the truth is actually much worse and more depressing. If you look at the work of demographer, an Austrian demographer, his name is Vigard Skirbeck, and he's done really fascinating work looking at data sets of population going back about 700 years. And what he's found is that fertility has always and everywhere been aspirational behavior in which the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum patterns its behavior on what the higher end is doing. And so the poor people are actually, you know, the less educated people are not just sort of unthinkingly, you know, popping out kids. They are emulating what the wealthy and well-educated people are doing. And that persists to today. I mean, you look at the fertility rates for people with the lowest incomes and the lowest education levels are higher than they are slightly for people at the higher end of the spectrum, but the trajectory is the same. They're both cutting back on having kids, and they're both having smaller families.
Interesting. This
is totally counterintuitive. It's one of the, like, you know, the many things that I sort of learned as I was researching this over the last 3 years.
I have some specific questions, but let's get going with a brief description of what your book is about, how you came to write it. What was it that inspired you to write a book on this topic in particular?
You know, so about 6 or 7 years ago, I read 3 books in a month, all of which vaguely alluded to demographics, and I am a big footnote and endnote nerd. I love those things. And all 3 books pointed to the same guy. His name is Phil Longman, and his book was The Empty Cradle. And I went and I read The Empty Cradle, and it struck me as like one of the most important books written over the last 20 years. It's just an amazing book. And I always tell people, everyone should own 2 books on demographics, and so I hope you'll buy my book and Phil's book. But if you're only going to buy one, you should probably skip mine and just go get Phil's, because it's so great. And so Phil is a good liberal progressive Democrat. He actually works here in Washington at a progressive think tank called the New America Foundation. And I went and I read basically everything he's ever written, and then I called him like a starstruck teenager, and I said, "Hi, Mr. Longman, could I have lunch with you sometime?" And he said, "Sure." And we went out, and he was just the nicest, like most amazingly impressive guy. Anyway, we sort of just started talking, and he's like, "Oh, you're interested in this stuff. You should talk to this guy, and you should read this, and you should read that." And I just then started tumbling down the rabbit hole, and demographics is like numerology, or like, you know, the study of celebrity breast implants. Once you start like seeing it, you see it everywhere, and you can't like unsee it.
Oh, that kind of leads to my next question, which is demographics destiny?
No, it's not. I mean, that's the old line about it, and it's sort of a charming line. It's clever in its own way, because things change. I mean, that's, you know, and I say this a lot during the book. I say, look, nobody has a crystal ball, and nobody can tell you what will happen. All we can do is look at the snapshots of data that we have now, look at the historical data, and sort of then understand how we got to now, and then sort of extrapolate into the future. dropped off the table at basically the same time. Nobody could have foreseen that. Nobody knew that that was coming. And so, you know, things change. We just sort of have to be open to that and aware of that, and not think that the, you know, our fates are written in the stars, because they aren't. But what demographics does do, and this is Phil's line, and it's so good that I just sort of appropriated the book, and now I will give him credit for it, is that I like to think about demographics as like being the tectonic plates shifting underneath the earth. You know, they determine the topography of modern life. They sort of determine the realm of what is possible, but they aren't actually creating destiny for us.
What is the most surprising thing you learned as you were doing your research?
You know, there were a lot of them. It's always sort of hard to pick one. One of them was the idiocracy thing, actually. You know, we just sort of think, I think, naturally that, you know, oh, well, that's how it worked. You know, we're going to be outbred by all the people at the low end of the scale. And it isn't. It's not how it works. The other thing is just about family size, ideal family size in America. I think that most people assume, I know I assumed, that Americans have really changed over the course of the last 40 years. They don't want families that are very big anymore. They're much more focused on themselves and their careers. And then sort of the old idea of a traditional family is just sort of outmoded, not attractive anymore. And that's not true. Demographers measure what's called ideal fertility, and that's the number of kids that people say they want to have in a perfect world. And in America, our ideal fertility rate is 2.5. That is sort of surprising, because it's quite high. But what's really surprising is that it's been about 2.5 for 40 years now. It's been very constant. And so what the real thing that's happened then isn't that people have adjusted their attitudes about how many kids they want to have. What's happened is that sort of, you know, life has gotten in the way, and people have found themselves not being able to achieve the family that they want in theory.
I was interested to read an article, I think it was in the Washington Post on Sunday, by David Ignatius, referring to some studies by Nicholas Eberstadt.
Yeah, I saw that piece, too. It's great, isn't it?
Yeah, and it surprised me that he was saying that the birth rate in Muslim countries, and I guess in a large number of Arab countries, has actually plummeted at a greater rate than it has in the West. And are you familiar with these studies?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of people have been, Nick wrote a great paper about this last year. A lot of people have been sort of keeping tabs on this. David Goldman wrote a book about this called How Civilizations Die. I think it came out last year. It's very good. You know, but it isn't just Muslim countries. I mean, in a way, it's actually sort of unsurprising, but it's all countries. When you look out to the developing world, while the absolute number of the fertility rate is still higher than it is here in the West for the most part, their rates have declined. And this is sort of hard for people to, this is why people like drop out of calculus, because, you know, thinking about slopes of curves and DXDT is a little bit strange and counterintuitive. But the rates of decline in most of the developing world is much steeper than it is here in the West even. And this is the same then for many of the Muslim countries.
Now, what is the interaction between birth rate and immigration in terms of what the future of the United States is? As our birth rate declines and immigration fluxes, how will that make a difference in the way we live 40 or 50 years from now?
Well, you know, the real question is about the fertility rate in Central and South America. Now, historically, countries which have fertility rates below the replacement level don't send immigrants out into the world. So right now, we have all of the countries in Central and South America experiencing dramatic declines in their fertility rates. About half of them, a little less than half, are already sub-replacement, and the sub-replacement countries do not send immigrants up here to America. We get very few immigrants from Uruguay, Brazil, and Costa Rica, and Puerto Rico. So the question is, within 20 years, which is when we think that most of Central and South America will finally settle below the replacement rate, will we continue to receive immigration from those countries the way we have previously? Mexico is like the big question here, the big open question. Over the last 5 years, Mexico has traditionally given us 2 out of every 3 of our immigrants. Over the last 5 years, our net immigration from Mexico has been 0. And so what's going on over there? Well, first, we've had the Great Recession. The economists all say this is recession-based, and once the economy recovers, we'll be fine. The demographers say not so fast. Mexico's fertility rate has totally collapsed in the last 25 years, and right now they are just above the replacement rate. Within about 5 years, they should be well below it. And so are we undergoing a structural change from Mexico? You know, is it possible that Mexican immigration won't come back? That's really the biggest question. You know, regardless of what we do here on the policy side with immigration, whether we have amnesty or fences or whatnot, it's that supply side which is really going to determine what our future looks like.
Where in the world are the trends in the opposite direction? Where are people having more children than less?
Only a couple places. Only 3% of the world's population has not experienced the giant fertility decline. And so Nigeria is one of them. The West Bank and the Palestinian territories are another. And I believe, if you catch me in other words, I believe the other one might be Bangladesh, but don't hold me to that. It's in the book somewhere, but only dimly remember what the third one is. Sorry.
Well, the Nigerian example is quite salient given what's going on in West and Sahelian Africa right now. That's going to make a big difference. That pretty much covers my substantive question. My next question is basically where are you going to be making appearances in the D.C. or Virginia areas, you know, book signings or lectures or anything in the next couple of weeks?
Boy, I have to go look at my calendar because I really have been going day to day, just feeling where I'm told. I'm going to be at Heritage Foundation's blogger briefing next Tuesday, which I think is open to most people. Next, I'm going to be at the 101 group on Capitol Hill next Thursday. And then I'm seeing at a group called Tenio, which has a dinner in March. That's March 19th. But, you know, I'll do weddings and bar mitzvahs. I'll do anything. This has been a really weird 2 weeks for me, like not at all in normal life, where I sort of just go from, like, you know, interview to interview to interview, and hopefully that will be ending after next week, and I can get back to normal life, and I can actually, like, talk to real people whenever they, you know, are interested in speaking to me.
Well, good luck with that. I may try to catch you at Heritage next week. I expect to be in D.C. on Tuesday for another meeting, so I'll
That'd
see
be
if
great.
I can
And really,
that.
You know, your office is a hot 15 seconds from mine, so I have a six-week-old kid at home. I'm at Caribou all the time when I am at work.
Okay.
So if people want to grab a cup of coffee, just shoot me an email.
I'd love to do that. That sounds great. Well, thanks for your time today.
Well, thanks for having me. It was lovely.
I'm going to try to get a copy of your book and actually read it.
Oh well, I hope you like it. Okay. I've tried to make it as sort of engaging as a book with numbers about policy can be engaging. So you can tell me to what extent I succeed.
Well, I hope that you do succeed because that's the sort of thing I like to read. Thanks again for your time. I look forward to meeting you in person.
Great. Take care, Rick.
Okay. Thanks again. Bye.
Bye.
Did you miss a previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at bearingdrift.com.
That's all the time we have this week on The Score. For all the writers and editors at Bearing Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. We'll be back next week with more news, reviews, and interviews. Be sure to tell your friends where to find us and join the conversation at bearingdrift.com.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bearing Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit bearingdrift.com.